Yeah, so just one second here. Is it Mr. James?
Yes, sir.
Good morning to you and Ms. Johnson Wiles. You are also here today. Do either council have any questions before we begin? Very good. Mr. James, you may approach and you may proceed.
The authority of the director of the Department of Motor Vehicles to administratively revoke an operator's license is only that which is specifically conferred by the administrative license revocation statutes. Now, this case is unique in as much as the hearing officer submitted proposed findings of fact, conclusion of law, and a recommended order to the director, which apparently the director took issue with, and then in turn, somebody unknown to this day from the department contacted the hearing officer ex parte to direct, request, what have you, the hearing be reopened without any notice to Mr. Pope or opportunity to be heard on that. And then what happened after that, obviously from the record, is there was a second hearing set after the August 11th hearing, where the director then subpoenaed an arresting officer to come in and testify to an issue that came up with regard to a notary acknowledgement and an effort to bolster the record to support a revocation. Now, in my brief, I probably misspoke.
Was Mr. Pope, were you present at that, shall we call it, the second hearing?
I was present, yes, Your Honor. Okay. Now, and I misspoke in my brief too, because I do believe the issue is there was no final order when the hearing officer submitted her proposed findings of fact, conclusion of the law, and recommended order for the director to appeal from. But what the director could do at that point then, and I think the district court may be correct in this regard, is you can accept, she could accept or reject the findings of the officer. What the director cannot do is then communicate or have somebody on her behalf communicate with
the hearing officer. What is your authority for the director cannot do that?
To do what? To read?
You just said the director cannot do thus and such. What's your authority for that?
Well, there is a statute that talks about 84914 subdivision 6C and D that talks about ex parte communications from an agency head or employee with a hearing officer, and that would be in the point of time, I believe, after a notice of hearing is submitted for the parties, and that prohibits ex parte communication, and at a minimum would require the hearing officer, agency head, or employee to document or memorialize what had occurred and give the party that was not involved with that opportunity notice to respond. So there is that statute there. I think there's also, when you look at the Murray case, which I know the state cited to, Murray contemplated things that were happening before there was actually a hearing, and all the statutes speak to a hearing. It doesn't say hearings, plural. And there is no authority, and that's the point here, is that the department did not have the authority to reopen a closed record. It did not have the authority to communicate ex parte. The only authority, as noted by the hearing officer, which she's correct in this regard, is, and I think it was in response to my statement on the record, is there's regulations under 051.01H that allows the appellant to request the hearings be kept open before they're closed to submit additional evidence, but nothing that allows even us to supplement the record after a hearing or move to reopen a hearing. In fact, I wish there was, because I would like to see a hearing officer's recommendation and then be able to say, oh, I want to reopen the hearing so I can address that issue. That's not how it works. There's one hearing. You have the hearing. So what the director was left with at the end of the day, and the statutory authority that she had, was to, you know, accept it, reject it. If she rejected it, under the regs, it's I think section 56 of the regs, she can then render her findings and say, and conclusions, and then Mr. Pope could appeal from that. But you can't, what the due process violation here is that we're having this communication, reopening the record without us being involved in the process and kept in the dark. There's no transparency. And then we have a situation where we don't know what's going on.
Yeah, what's the finding findings of fact and conclusions of law, what's the effect of that from the hearing officer?
It's recommended.
Like just a recommendation.
It's a recommendation, and that's why I said the department can ex. And I shouldn't say appeal. That I shouldn't have said that.
That's my next question.
No,
the department wouldn't appeal.
It's not a final order because it's a recommended. That's why I said that up front here. I prefaced it. That's incorrect. Looking back at this, I think that the correct analysis is the department or the director can reject or accept. And if she rejects, then she makes her own findings.
Based on the record that was presented to the director can reject, accept, make their own ruling.
Right. And that's why the regulations under Section 56 say that she could do that. Because what usually happens, we know, is they make recommendations and the director adopts them and then she doesn't make her own findings. But that they specifically said she is to if she doesn't adopt it. So that's what the director would do.
Thank you.
And that's the rub here is that there's no authority here whatsoever to allow for multiple hearings. And this is not like Murray where we're acting in an investigative, the director's acting or the department's acting in an investigatory capacity to try to figure out if we need an addendum beforehand. This is after a hearing has been completed and the record closed. And that makes a huge difference because, again, there's no authority to reopen a hearing anywhere.
So your real claim is that they erred in opening up the record to allow additional, this case, testimony by the officer about the notary and signing the document. Is that correct?
That's one of the errors. Yes, Your Honor.
So how were you ultimately prejudiced by that?
Well, you're prejudiced by that because you're... the prejudice comes from how can the department act outside its authority to do these kinds of things and how many bites at the apple is it's going to get? Because when the legislature changed the statute to say that the director doesn't, the department doesn't have to bring in officers anymore, the burden then obviously is on us, they said, to bring the officers. So the burden's on us. We presented the evidence to meet our burden of proof. A hearing officer recommends that the revocation be dismissed, and then we have another hearing.
You have another hearing, and you're outside allowed to come in and participate at the hearing. So what didn't you get?
Well, it's what didn't we get if you're asking about due process? We didn't get an opportunity to argue about the fact that there should be another hearing. That's where the due process arises, and we have communication.
Were you able to argue that at the second hearing?
But I don't think I was. I didn't know what happened because there was nothing memorialized to tell us what transpired behind closed doors. How can I raise that as an issue? I wasn't even certain who communicated with the hearing officer, and that's why I cited 84914 subdivision 6C. How could I preserve that when I don't know who was there and what was talked about? I would have loved to preserve that and say, this was wrong because you did this, that, and the other. But there was no memorandum. If you look at it under 84914 subdivision 6D, there should have been if there was those ex parte communications going on. That's the prejudice here, is that we should at least be allowed an opportunity for that. And with that, I would reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Ms. Johnson-Wiles, good morning to you.
May it please the court, counsel, Melissa Johnson-Wiles appearing on behalf of the Department of Motor Vehicles. The appellant raises two main arguments in the briefing and in the argument today. The first is a jurisdictional challenge to the sufficiency of the sworn report. And then secondly, complaints about the director's failure to adopt the hearing officer's flawed reasoning and the procedures surrounding that denial. The answer to the first argument is found in the four corners of the sworn report that was received by the director of the Department of Motor Vehicles on July 20th, 2020. Nothing in the administrative hearings on August 11th or August 25th changed the jurisdictional question on the sworn report. The jurisdictional sufficiency of the sworn report was the sole issue raised by the appellant at the administrative hearing, and it is also dispositional. Yes.
The first hearing or the second hearing?
The first hearing. And that's what this is all about, is the jurisdictional sufficiency of the sworn report. It's dispositional. So everything that happened, the procedures that surrounded the denial, ultimately get back to the four corners of the sworn report.
So why did we have this second hearing?
Well, it was unnecessary, as we indicated in our brief.
So we disregard everything that came after that, or as a result of that second hearing?
Well, on the issue presented, it was unnecessary. So I would like to talk about the jurisdictional sufficiency of this sworn report. This was, again, the only challenge made by the appellant at his administrative hearing to challenge the revocation. And he argued that because his copy of the sworn report given to him at the time of arrest at approximately 1:30 a.m. in the morning was signed by the law enforcement officer, that it translated into a defective sworn report. But that was not the case. As the official sworn report received by the director within 10 days after arrest was separately signed by the law enforcement officer and fully acknowledged by the notary.
So Mr. Pope's notice was different than what was submitted to the department?
Mr. Pope's copy of the sworn report, the notice temporary license, had Officer Meyer's signature on the left side, but the one that was submitted to the director had Officer Meyer's signature on the right side.
So it was different?
It was different, yes.
Is there a statutory or other requirement that Mr. Pope get the same copy of the document as the department?
On the question of jurisdiction, no. The requirement is that he receive a copy of the sworn report, the notice of revocation and temporary license, and those are all in one form.
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller-Lerman. I think maybe I'm not following the vocabulary. Is it your position that a report, sometimes called a sworn report, which is not sworn to, not notarized, is nevertheless a sufficient sworn report for jurisdictional purposes in the era since officers were required to appear?
No. This sworn report needs to be sworn to be jurisdictional.
And was there a defect with that which was submitted at the first hearing?
No. The sworn report conferred jurisdiction on the director of the Department of Motor Vehicles when it was properly received and fully notarized on July 20th, 2020, which is found in the department's administrative transcript at page 24. Now, it was additionally offered as exhibit number 2 at the administrative hearing, but the jurisdiction attached when it was received by the director of the Department of Motor Vehicles 9 days after Pope's arrest.
But Mr. Pope didn't get the copy Mr. Pope got was not the same as the copy the department got, is that correct?
The copy that he received, and it's prepared in triplicate, so his copy that was given to him at the time of arrest at 1:30 a.m., the officer did sign it on the left-hand side of the report. As far as the one that was submitted to the director, according to procedures, and this can bear out in the transcript, he does receive a copy of that fully notarized sworn report that is submitted to the Department of Motor Vehicles.
When did he receive that?
Sometime before the hearing. He had a copy of it.
The first hearing. Okay.
Yeah. So he had a copy of it. He knew.
Is that in the record?
There was actually, what?
He got a record of the same copy before the hearing?
Yes, it would be in the notice of hearing for the first hearing, kind of outlines that the exhibits are provided ahead of time. There was a lot of discussion about it during the initial administrative hearing. He objected to it, not because he didn't have a copy. He objected to it for other reasons, jurisdictional, which would be futile because jurisdiction had already attached on July 20th.
Is this typically how it occurs, or is it typically notarized and then given a copy to the driver?
The notarized copy always goes to the director of the Department of Motor Vehicles.
So the driver never gets a notarized copy before?
No. They'll get a copy of that notarized copy prior to the hearing, But no, no. I mean, these arrests occur in the middle of the night. Notaries aren't necessarily along for the ride when the law enforcement
They're taking the law enforcement centers. They're giving tests. They're incarcerated.
I'm not saying it's impossible. I didn't mean to suggest that it was impossible.
Law enforcement center.
Right.
So it's not like we would anticipate a notary driving along with the officer anticipating a situation.
Right.
But there's no.
So, but I think.
But there's no anticipation of a notary being available in a rural jail 24 hours a day, is there?
No. No. But I think the point that is important here is not that he's arguing that his copy was not notarized and that somehow he that there was a requirement that he have one, which the answer is no. It's that he argued that because his copy had the officer's signature, that by extrapolation, somehow he signed it before it was notarized. That's his argument. That was his argument to the administrative hearing officer, which she agreed to, that the director rejected.
Well, apparently he did sign it before it was notarized.
He did sign it, but he signed it again when it was notarized. So the four corners of the sworn report tell us all we need to know on this.
Who filled out the jury, the information contained within the acknowledgement from the notary?
Yes.
Who filled that out?
So, well, he testified in the second hearing that he wrote down his name and badge number in the jurat section. Yes.
Not the notary. Does that have any bearing?
Well, the Uniform Recognition of Acknowledgements Act does not require that a notary fill out that jurat. Instead, it requires that the notary attest to the fact that the person appeared before them, that they were personally known to them, or had sufficient information to know that they were the person that was appearing before them and attested to the document. And over the official seal, as outlined in the Uniform Acknowledgements Act, Recognition of Acknowledgements Act, that signature and seal of the notary is presumptive evidence that it was duly sworn to by the person.
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller-Lerman. So I'm trying to keep up with what the state is proposing that the act requires. So when it's a notary, they just, in your view, then they need to just confirm that this person is this person, but that person doesn't need to sign in front of the notary. Is that your position?
No. And I did not mean to suggest that. Under State versus Moyer, this court had found that the signature of the law enforcement officer on the sworn report is a corporal act, which kind of undertakes that duty to swear to the document. So the signature in front of the notary is important. That happened here. The four corners of the sworn report don't tell us that it didn't happen here. In fact, there's a presumption that it did. Under the Uniform Recognition of Acknowledgements Act and this court's determination of that recognition of that in Johnson versus Knapp. So no, we're not suggesting that at all. And actually the testimony bared out to show exactly what the four corners of the sworn report provided. This was a signature. He did sign it at the time of arrest, but he signed it in front of a notary.
Thank you. And I guess to return to one of the other topics then, what's the authority for reopening the record and having a second hearing, a do-over, or is that unkind?
I think that I appreciate the question, and I think it would be unkind to say that it was a do-over. I think there were some, a counsel for the appellant admits, this was a unique situation, and it was a unique situation.
Let's assume for the purpose of arguments today that the second hearing doesn't pass the smell test. What is this court supposed to do about the second argument?
Well, even if you find that this procedure was inappropriate or that the director did not have authority, which we believe she does, actually, and as outlined in our brief on Murray versus Neff, as far as getting to the bottom of jurisdiction. And keep in mind, that if at that second hearing, the officer had testified, that's not my signature, it's a forgery, we wouldn't be here. Okay, this is about jurisdiction only. It's not a do-over. The jurisdiction can attach at the time that it was received by the director of the Department of Motor Vehicles, which is why it is so important. So even if you felt that this was unfair, he actually had an opportunity to object to it, and he did object to it, but there was no prejudice in this case at all. It didn't change the fact that the only issue that he raised had already been addressed by the sworn report. It was a little messy. It was unique. It is not a normal practice, but there was nothing about it that prejudiced him in any way.
Before you sit down, I have one other question. I see that the order was entered on August 27th with a 1-year suspension going back to July 26, 2020. Was that suspension stayed?
No.
So that has expired. He has been reinstated. His driver license privilege has been reinstated.
I assume the time has passed. So,
he might not be reinstated, but he is eligible for reinstatement. Why is this matter not moot?
That's a good question. I think it's true that that he would not, well, and he would not be able to, would not need to have his driver's license back if he's already gotten it. I think I'll leave the rest to him. So, okay. So if I just may just really briefly, since I mentioned State versus or Moyer versus Department of Motor Vehicles, in response to the question from Justice Miller-Lerman, the citation for that, and it might be in Murray, but the citation for that is 275 Nebraska 688. And that was the one about the signature of the officer as the corporal act in signing the sworn report. And with that, thank you very much for your time today, and ask that the decision of the district court be affirmed.
If the matter is moot, do you have an argument that we should decide it under the public interest exception?
No.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 1 minute and 53 seconds. So we'll give you an extra 30 seconds there on top of that minute and 53 seconds. Mr. James.
Well, I'll ask you real quick. Has your client been reinstated?
Your Honor, actually, I'm not sure on that. I haven't checked with him to see if he is.
And what's your position on the mootness issue?
The position on the mootness issue is this may happen again. If we have this happen one time, and although I'll tell you, I don't know that it's too often you see a hearing officer recommend something that the department won't adopt. But if that happens again, this will come up again. So in that's it's likely to reoccur. And I think you would find that the department would take this authority and do that again. On top of that, it still stays on my
clients. Is that a public interest argument?
Yes. Well, I think it is. And it still stays on his driving record. And that affects insurance. That affects a lot of different things in his life. And there is prejudice that suffered from that because it's not taken off of his driving record.
This won't affect his criminal conviction, so.
It won't affect it. It will affect him administratively down the road if something else were to happen in terms of things on his driver's license. Yes, that's a concern. I do want to point out, though, when the assistant attorney general argued that we know everything by the four corners of the document, I'm not sure which document she's referring to, other than if it was the last one after the one that was given my client, which they are the same, as you can see, except for the officer signed the one, and there's no acknowledgement on that one that was given to my client, and then there is on the second.
But your client was given a copy.
He was yes.
That was a second one that went to the department. Also,
I'll concede. Yes, he was given it. We were provided that as part of the exhibits before the hearing. Yes, but the problem we have here is that then we have the second hearing to clarify what the department must have also thought was a problem for departmental jurisdiction because they're reopening the record. That's the rub, is you've got that second signature that the hearing officer said was illegible. You couldn't read it. And it was included in the notary acknowledgement itself, which is where the officer is not supposed to sign. That's why I cite, or the ARNDT case, ARNDT, talks about you need to have a signature from an arresting officer on a sworn report. That's different than other affidavits in different contexts. So the problem with that too is he's acting as his own notary at that point, because it's not the notary that's including his name in the notary acknowledgement. And that's why I cited to Johnson. It's he's basically putting his name, and the notary may not ever know who he is. She's not acknowledging as to who's appearing before. He needs to sign above the arresting officer's signature line to identify who he is in the presence of a notary, which we offered the first report to show he did not do that, because this it's obviously not in the presence of the signatures on there, and it's not been notarized. So with that, I'll submit unless there's more questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Council, that concludes arguments in Pope versus Department of Motor Vehicles. You are excused.